This is Mornings with Kale in Northern Colorado's Voice, 1310 KFKA.
How bizarre. How bizarre. How bizarre.
Well, even though bacon, like everything else, bacon, getting a little bit pricey, I've got a question for you this morning. I'll bet you can answer it. 970-353-1310. Unlike 41% of children, drop me a text. I'll give you that question. 888-530-0043. Where does bacon come from? Ryan Kelly at the con, behind the glass, my musical maestro, my technical producer. From whence does bacon come?
Pig.
No, yes.
Yeah.
Ding, 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 pork, ding, ding.
Pork.
Yes.
Is it the behind of the pig? Is that right?
The nether regions of the pig?
Yeah.
Well, you got the porky part right. 41.
Okay.
Yeah. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Seriously. Hang on to your hangers.
Okay.
41% of children think that bacon comes from a plant.
What?
I kid you not. Well, you know what, though? I do kind of understand the confusion with all those faux meats. I'm not talking about Subway tuna, by the way. Ooh, but with all those faux meats out there. Well, and that's not even faux. It's just not necessarily tuna. It could be fish. Could be cattle.
Right.
But, you know, you've got, you know, the Impossible Burger. You've got Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat. So, and you've seen all of those commercials on TV, no doubt. And kids are kind of, you know, eating that up as well, where, there's one where you've got a child asking an older guy, working at a food truck, I guess. I don't know, or at a food stand saying, "Hey, want to have a burger? It's made out of plants." And so, the kid goes on to say, "Hey, if I like it, you'll like it too." And so the man takes a bite and goes, that is good. So I guess I could understand the confusion, but really 41% of kids think that bacon come from a plant.
Now that's bizarre.
Yeah. Hence our musical commentary this morning. Oh, wait, but it doesn't stop there. Wait, there's more. A similar number of kids also think hamburgers, and again, I kind of understand that thought process there, and hot dogs come from plants as well.
Really? That's funny. I mean, I guess that makes sense with all the, you know, obviously the plant-based, you know, stuff we've been seeing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, hot dogs, arguably, probably would be better for us if they did come from plants.
Yeah, probably. Probably. At least get some fiber in here or something, I don't know.
All right. Well, here's a tell, okay? Now, you'd think the kids would have gotten this right. Chicken nuggets. Chicken nuggets. Isn't the giveaway in the name?
Yes.
Oh. Mm-mm. No, they're not picking up. No. Mm-mm. No, no, no. Even though chicken nuggets have the source in their name, more than a third of kids categorized chicken nuggets as a plant-based food.
Interesting. It's now, just a way of, you know, it's just a way of cooking now, right? Who cares about what's in it? It's just, you know, what it's called.
Well, and that does beg the question, and, you know, no offense to chicken nugget devotees everywhere, but what is in a chicken nugget? Technically chicken, right?
Yeah, technically.
Technically.
In all technicality, it's chicken.
Chicken.
But, you know. But,
Did you ever dissect one?
I feel like I have. I remember the ones that they used to serve for, like, middle school and high school lunch being, like, very, like, vascular and, like, kind of gross.
And, like, vascular, no!
Yeah. And they'd have, like, veins sometimes and just, like, look. Not necessarily the best.
That's it. I mean, I'm out. I mean, shepherd pie was bad enough, but vascular chicken nuggets? Oh, no. No, those are two terms that just should never, ever meet. You know?
Yeah, literally.
Meet.
Meet me.
Meet. Okay, but there's still more. On the other hand, you had nearly 47% of kids in this survey identifying French fries as an animal-based food.
What? It's all completely screwed up now.
I know it is. You say potato, I say potato. Yeah, right. Popcorn, almonds, also commonly misclassified as animal-based.
Huh? What? Do they just think like these like animals like shed this off? It's like either like, you know, some sort of like byproduct by them, like I don't know.
Doing double duty, these animals are.
Yeah, really.
Here, have a nice steak and why not a topping of some nice slivered almonds? I can provide that too. All right. So apparently the survey asked 176 kids ages 4 to 7. Okay, they are young, where certain foods come from. Children did not judge animals to be appropriate food sources in the study, but they also didn't really know that many of the foods they eat the most come from animals. All right, but here's the kicker, and I think this explains it all. The study was actually published in the Journal of Environmental Psychology, but here's the kicker. Its authors linked meat eating to climate change. Oh, the cattle flatulence. But where are they picking this up? Where are kids getting the idea? I mean, I think we all knew, even at the relatively young age of 4, at least by the time we were 7, that a burger comes from a cow.
I feel like I knew that. Right. I feel like that was something that was, you know, planted in my mind at a young age. Planted.
I see what you did
there. Yeah.
You can't make this stuff up. You really, really can't. All right. Well, talking about things that are so bizarre. I don't know if you watched the closing arguments in that Rittenhouse murder trial yesterday. I mean, for me, first you got the judge getting into trouble because he's making fun of Asian food. I mean, for me, watching the proceedings was almost, it was kind of like a cross between Hee Haw and Deliverance. And we're talking about a murder trial here. I mean, just the mass confusion that was shared by the judge and the legal teams on jury instructions aside, I mean, they spent so much time delving into these jury instructions, which, again, are pretty arcane and pretty difficult to understand, which begs the question, well, then why aren't they written in a more understandable way? Because if they, talking about the judge and the prosecution, the defense attorneys, if they can't understand the jury instructions, well, then how can the jurors? Oh, but it gets worse. You had this murder trial wrapping up just yesterday with lengthy closing statements by the attorneys. Now, you had Assistant District Attorney Thomas Binger. He led the prosecution. He delivered closing arguments that lasted for over 2 hours. Okay, fine. Rittenhouse is represented by defense attorney Mark Richards. Now, as you're probably well aware, Rittenhouse, 18, is on trial for fatally shooting Joseph Rosenbaum, 36, and later Anthony Huber, 26, as well as wounding a citizen journalist who caught most of this on his iPhone, Gage Groskowitz, 27, this in Kenosha on August 25th, 2020, during the protests and all of the civil unrest following the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Now, for his part, Rittenhouse says he was there because he was concerned about his community. He said he was there to erase graffiti, and there's also video showing him put out dumpster fires, but he was armed. And you have to wonder if, as the prosecution readily makes the case, if that led to the shootings that transpired. Certainly part of the equation. But at one point in his closing, you had Binger, okay? This is Assistant District Attorney Thomas Binger, picking up the AR-15 rifle that Rittenhouse had used, and he pointed the rifle at people in the courtroom with his finger on the trigger, imitating, in his estimation, how Rittenhouse instigated the fatal shooting. Shades of Alec Baldwin here and the tragedy on the set of Rust. But, undeterred, Binger said, well, this is what provokes the entire incident. I'm not sure, so sure it's that cut and dried. How about you? 970-353-1310. Drop me a text on our text line, 888-530-0043. Now, it gets weirder. In another truly bizarre moment, you had Binger arguing that Rittenhouse, quote, brought a gun to a fist fight by bringing the firearm to the protest, using an image from Patrick Swayze's 1989 film, Roadhouse. Roadhouse! What the heck was he thinking? Binger said to the jury, what you don't do is you don't bring a gun to a fist fight. Well, there's a considerable amounts of video imagery showing that not only Rittenhouse was armed. What the defendant wants you to believe is that because he's the one who brought the gun, he gets to kill. Seems like a stretch to me. Binger also harshly mocked Rittenhouse for his, quote, performance as a medic that night, close quote, responding to a video taken that night in which Rittenhouse claimed he was an EMT. Now, Mark Richards, Rittenhouse's defense attorney, wrapped up the defense's closing arguments Monday, making a pretty bold claim, saying that every person who was shot was attacking Kyle, going on to say there was no threatening behavior that started this. Mr. Rosenbaum was hell-bent on causing trouble that night. He did what he did, and he started that. Now, there are tragic parts of it, but Kyle Rittenhouse's behavior was protected under the law in the state of Wisconsin. The law of self-defense. He went on to say hands and feet can cause great bodily harm. Well, so can a skateboard that was used, that was cracked down on Mr. Rittenhouse's head. Well, today, names will be drawn to determine which 12 of the 18 jurors will deliberate and decide whether Rittenhouse is guilty or not. Well, that's assuming that they're able to figure out the jury instructions so they're somewhat intelligible for the jury. And in advance of that, you've got 500 members of the Wisconsin National Guard activated just in case of violence as a result of the jury's decision. But some really, really strange moments from these closing arguments of the Rittenhouse murder trial. 620 now, Northern Colorado's Voice, 103.1, 1310, KFKA, Mornings with Gail. This time check sponsored by the Candlelight Dinner Playhouse in Johnstown, where an incredible production of The Sound of Music begins November 26th. For show tickets and information, all you have to do is jump online, visit ColoradoCandlelight.com. Candlelight Dinner Playhouse, Broadway, in your backyard.
Everything you need to know about Northern Colorado is on NoCo Now. Weekdays at 9 on Northern Colorado's Voice. 103.1 and 1310 KFKA. Northern Colorado's Voice and the leader in prep sports is 103.1 and 1310 KFKA.
As you've heard in our news, State Senator Barbara Kirkmeier, Weld County Republican, someone you in Weld County know quite well, launched her campaign just yesterday to represent Colorado's new, writes Jesse Paul in the Colorado Sun, highly competitive 8th Congressional District. Now, Kirkmeier is the second Republican to announce a bid in the district. This newly created district, by the way, spans from the northeast Denver suburbs of Thornton, North Glen, and Brighton, yes, into Greeley. Weld County Commissioner Lori Sain jumped into the race earlier this month. Now, as you're well aware, before being elected to the State House in 2020, Barbara Kirkmeier spent two decades as Weld County Commissioner. She's a very staunch supporter of Colorado's oil and gas industry. She's lived in southern Weld County for more than 35 years. So tell you what, we're going to check in with Barbara Kirkmeier, State Senator Barbara Kirkmeier, who just announced her bid for the U.S. House in the state's new 8th Congressional District when she joins us this morning right around 8:05. Now, on the Democratic side of the 8th District race, you've got State Representative Yadira Caraveo, a Thornton Democrat, running to represent the district, as is Chaz Tedesco, an Adams County Commissioner. Now, you've also got two political newcomers jumping into the fray. They've also filed to run in the Republican primary, Juliana Jules Gray, who is a wedding photographer, and Ryan Gonzalez, whose LinkedIn profile says he is a banker. So again, State Senator Barbara Kirkmeier joins us this morning to talk a little bit about her campaign for Colorado's 8th Congressional District seat at 8:05. All right, got into a conversation just a little bit off topic, which we're prone to do, with Tracy Axton, FMS Bank. She said she had just heard that the COVID-19 pandemic was moving to being termed an endemic. But have we gotten there yet? And how will we know when COVID-19 has gone from pandemic to endemic? Well, like so many things COVID-19 related, it's seemingly more subjective than you might think. We'll get into the details of that in just a few. 6:30 now, Northern Colorado's Voice, 103.1, 1310, KFKA.
Join Clark Johnson and Bruce Dick for Clark and the Coach. Weekdays at 11 on Northern Colorado's Voice, 103.1 and 1310 KFKA.
This is Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, and you're listening to Mornings with Gail on Northern Colorado's Voice, 103.1 and 1310 KFKA.
Six 37 on your Tuesday morning, Northern Colorado's Voice, 103.1, 1310 KFKA. Mornings with Gail. Now, bouncing off a conversation we had yesterday with Tracy Axton, FMS Bank. Sure, we talk about the Fed and we talk about inventory when it comes to the housing market throughout Northern Colorado and interest rates as well. But we tend to, you know, every once in a while go down a rabbit hole or two. And we did just that yesterday, talking about whether we have crossed that rather wide chasm of COVID-19 transitioning from pandemic to endemic. Well, it's kind of subjective, and I have been holding on to some background information on that very subject because this topic of conversation has popped up in a number of conversations I've had with many of you, because I think we can all agree on one thing. COVID-19 is not going away. And anyone who tells you anything different, Well, let's just say they're not being fully on the up and up in their characterization of it. Broad consensus among many experts is that it's just not realistic to think we're totally going to eradicate SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19. We will, however, at some point in time, see it move out of the pandemic phase and into the endemic phase. All right, so just in the interest of a clarification, what does that mean? Well, that means that the virus will indeed continue to circulate in parts of the world for years, but that its prevalence and its overarching impact will decrease to relatively manageable levels, so that it becomes, as we've talked about for many, many months now, that it eventually will become more like the garden variety flu, which, yes, does claim numerous lives each and every year, but it'll be more like that flu than it is a world-stopping disease, as we have seen over the past, 18, 19 months. Jen Cates is Director of Global Health and HIV Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She said, for now, we have to remember that we're still in a pandemic with this virus. We're not yet at a point where we're living with an endemic COVID. When we get to that point, some of this will be much, much easier. But unfortunately, we're just not there. So how will we know when we are there? Is there some clear threshold or some magical metric that will tell us objectively and undeniably? Well, unfortunately, as with so many things COVID-19 related, the answer is both yes and no. Now, for an infectious disease to be classed in the endemic phase, the rate of infections has to more or less stabilize across years, although you will see occasional seasonal increases. For example, in the winter, those are pretty well expected. A disease is endemic if the reproductive number is stably at one. This is according to Boston University epidemiologist Eleanor Murray. Ms. Murray says that means one infected person on average infects only one other person. But right now, that's not the case. Each person who is infecting is currently infecting more than one person. And of course, as you're well aware, that's largely due to the hypercontagious Delta variant and the fact that most of the global population doesn't yet have immunity, whether through vaccination or infection. So susceptibility is still pretty high. Now, for a while, there had been hope that the arrival of vaccines would mean that we would reach herd immunity. That is, when enough of the population has gained immunity to confer protection to everyone. But seems as though the medical experts are backing away from that. Their rationalization there is that we have failed to vaccinate enough people and we're seeing more contagious variants of COVID-19 pop up, wouldn't say daily, but there are a number of new variants beyond that widely publicized Delta variant. But getting the virus's reproductive number down to just one, well, apparently that's just the bare minimum for earning that endemic classification. There are other factors that come into play as well. And once again, assessing those factors is more subjective than anything else. In general, a virus becomes endemic when we, health experts, governmental bodies, and the public collectively decide, as though we can collectively decide on anything these days, that we're okay with accepting the level of impact that the virus has. Obviously, that's a tricky thing. people have varying levels of risk aversion and risk acceptance. So obviously it follows that we're going to differ on to as to what constitutes an acceptable level. The worst outcome, of course, from becoming infected with COVID-19, obviously death. As I said earlier, the garden variety flu kills, well, anywhere between 12,000 and 52,000 Americans each year. This according to CDC estimates. It is deadly. Now, is that figure, air quote, acceptable, close air quote, or is it too high? Well, again, it depends on whom you speak with. You've got one epidemiologist at the University of Michigan School of Public Health saying, well, the way I think about it, Joshua Petrie is his name, even with, so aptly named, even with influenza, that's too much. But pretty much, and I think we can all agree on this point to some degree, as a society, we've decided that we will accept that level of mortality rather than taking measures to lower it by, say, wearing masks in the winter or mandating flu vaccines or shutting down large parts of the global economy. Similarly, with COVID-19, people will disagree about what constitutes an acceptable level of mortality. But that's not the only consideration here. As you're well aware, and I hope not from personal experience, COVID-19 can lead to those long-haul symptoms in a minority of cases. Estimates range from 10 to 30% in unvaccinated people, with a small number of vaccinated people also effective. The symptoms, like brain fog, memory loss, and fatigue, are sometimes so debilitating that the condition is recognized as a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act. The reasons why some people get long COVID and others recover quickly, well, those reasons are still not well understood. And the path to effective treatments for long haulers is pretty uncertain. Now, you've got one epidemiologist saying is what we want to get to is a stage where you don't have to worry about disruption because of COVID. The pandemic is over when all of the crises stop, not just when we get to a certain level of death. Again, though, determining when something stops being a crisis, well, it can be a bit subjective. There's one imminent development that makes so many hopeful about the pandemic phase winding down by 2022. And those are those vaccines for 5 to 11-year-olds that have been approved. You've got epidemiologist Murray saying, I think we have, once we have vaccines for all ages, she's a lot more hopeful about the control situation in the nation. Vaccinating school age kids, and again, this is a very personal decision, one that is up to you as a parent in doing what is best in the health of your children. But many saying vaccinating school-going kids is crucial because it'll protect them and because it will limit that community spread. Now, it was March of 2020, the oh-so-vaunted World Health Organization declared that novel coronavirus a pandemic. And soon after, of course, the government declared a national emergency. One by one, states followed suit. But you've got many experts saying as we move into the endemic phase, you can expect to watch this process happen in reverse. So until then, rather than thinking of what they call endemicity, and that, of course, is that transition between pandemic to endemic as an on-off switch next year, think of it more as a dimmer switch. again, like with so many things COVID-19 related, when we move from the definition of pandemic to endemic, well, is dependent on a whole lot of things. 648 now, Northern Colorado's Voice, 103.1, 1310, KFKA.
For the latest on the Broncos, the Nuggets, and the Rockies, listen to The Hull Show, weekdays at noon on Northern Colorado's Voice, 103.1 and 1310 KFKA. A Good Afternoon Guy with Brian Gary is coming up at 3 on Northern Colorado's Voice, 103.1 and 1310 KFKA.
Well, needless to say, we've added a ton of words to our lexicon, courtesy of COVID-19, but also the cool kids checking in, and in our It Pays to Increase Your Word Power segment, a word that I've never heard of, but I have a pretty good feeling that Ryan Kelly is familiar with the word that is so new to me, choogy. Choogy. Ryan, choogy? What the heck does that mean?
So choogy is basically like anything that, it's an obviously a new age term, but it's anything that's like not trendy or kind of considered like cringe nowadays.
Oh, cringeworthy.
Yeah.
Oh, a little cringy. Well, once again, just as you know where bacon comes from, you know the definition of choogy. Do you know that Gen Z has now declared, among with many other things, apparently they've denounced side parting your hair, and skinny jeans are a no-no these days. Oh, yeah. And most recently, AirPods. AirPods are not cool with Gen Z. Well, Gen Z has declared blonde hair as choogy.
I don't know. Okay, so I can see why for like skinny jeans and stuff like that. I don't know about the AirPods.
Yeah.
Really? I mean, I have the corded headphones as well as the AirPods, so I guess I can interchange if I would like to, if I want to, you know, fit the norm. But I don't know why blonde hair. I think everyone's just like trying to be kind of mysterious and like, ooh, alternative, you know?
Yes, yes. Well, apparently, and I had pulled this out of the New York Post, a piece by Samantha Ibrahim, gentlemen may prefer blondes, but not Gen Z. And thank you, TikTokers, who have taken to the platform saying that blonde hair is outdated and darker shades are in, saying that, yes, blonde hair is choogy, and being an quote, expensive brunette, close quote, is now the only way to go.
Well, thank God I'm expensive brunette, you know. That's what I have going for
you
me.
You don't
want
right
to
be now a cheap one, for heaven's sakes,
oh, no,
right?
Oh, no. I always have to be expensive.
All right. AirPods, though, you are a devotee. Do you know the Correct. Wall Street Journal actually did a story asking the question, are AirPods out, and why the cool kids are wearing wired headphones? It's because they want to be alone.
Maybe. I also like saw like some like supermodels and stuff. They were like started wearing, yeah, the wired headphones again. And then I think that's where it really started to come back.
Yeah.
Which is so stupid because, I mean, tech is tech, but, you know, whatever.
But wait, I mean, it gets much deeper. They're saying that AirPods have become too widespread to be considered cool. And the Wall Street Journal piece actually references those contrarian trend setters. But apparently the cord in the corded earbuds, which I'm a devotee of, also projects this you can't sit with me factor that some people, I want to be alone,
right,
that some people find appealing. It gives the air of do not disturb. So it's kind of subconsciously related to a type of grungy aesthetic, which is about being moody and having your physical barrier up.
I can see that. But also, like, what's the difference? The only difference with that is that it has a cord attached to it. I mean, like, if I had my AirPods and you could, like, see that I have them in, Mm-hmm. So it's like, I feel like having any sort of headphone in while, like, you know, going around is considered don't approach me, don't talk to me type thing, you know? But whatever. What do I know?
Well, I never made the switch, as many have, switching over to AirPods, because they're kind of pricey now, aren't they?
Yeah, I think, well, I have like the first or second gen, and I think when I bought them originally, they were like $120, $130.
Yikes.
But I think the new ones that they have
are
like $200 or so.
Yeah. The new generation ones are pretty darn pricey for sure. So, all right. So it's up to you. You don't want to be choogy. So choose your accessories and I suppose your hair color wisely. 657 now. Northern Colorado's Voice, 103.1, 1310, KFKA.
Prep Sports and the UNC Bears are on Northern Colorado's Voice. 103.1 and 1310 KFKA. Join Clark Johnson and Bruce Dick for Clark and the Coach. Weekdays at 11 on Northern Colorado's Voice. 103.1 and 1310 KFKA.
It's 6:59 now, Northern Colorado's Voice, 103.1, 1310 KFKA. Coming up, a lot to cover in our local news roundup, so stay with us for that. We'll get you up to speed on ABC News and local news. 1310 KFKA Greeley, it's 7 o'clock.